From London, it's the Wired.co.uk podcast, episode 44 for Friday, the 23rd of September, 2011. On the show this week, have we finally broken the speed of light? Particle physicists at the Large Hadron Collider have seen evidence of a particle travelling faster than the speed of light. If this is accurate, it could change everything we understand about the nature of the universe. And in the same week, Facebook overhauled its entire way of showcasing your life online, and neuroscientists may have just taken a massive leap towards being able to produce videos of what you've just dreamed. It's been a big week, so let's take a faster-than-light cruise through this week's Wired News.
Good intro.
Thank you. Ahoy hoy, it's Nate Langson here. I'm the...
Captain Nate Langson!
I'm the editor of Wired.co.uk. And joining me is news editor Duncan Gear.
Hello, first mate.
And of course, associate editor and ship wench... Olivia underscore Solon.
Too proud, thanks.
Honestly, it's been an interesting week for us all here. Later on, actually, today, we have a feature from Katie. Katie went to the 100% Design exhibition and saw some pretty insane stuff, including inflatable office buildings. So she's gone around and interviewed some pretty amazing people and designers, which we will hear from in a little bit. But first, shall we talk about Einstein, who's probably rolling in his grave right now. Have we broken the light barrier, Duncan?
Well, maybe. It's possible. Well, we haven't broken the light barrier. Wired has not broken the light barrier. Some neutrinos may have broken the light barrier.
So break this down for us. Break this absolutely down.
Well, what's happened is that some particle physicists at the Large Hadron Collider generated some neutrinos at CERN, which is on the Franco-Swiss border next to Geneva, and they then sensed them at the Gran Sasso laboratory, which is 732 kilometres away in Italy. And they were expecting it to arrive around the speed of light, but they actually arrived a fraction of a second just before they should have done.
Now, neutrinos are a subatomic particle, and they travel close to the speed of light anyway, so they're already very, very quick.
Yeah, and quite crucially, they kind of interact very, very weakly with the world, so they can kind of pass through absolutely everything in their way without any problems.
Now, the interesting side of this, and it's a very interesting side of this, is that if this is shown to be accurate and the particle has travelled faster than the speed of light, then Einstein's theory of special relativity, which states that nothing can travel faster than the speed of light, breaks down entirely.
And as a result, pretty much every bit of modern physics since that. And so if this does turn out to be true, it could be a bit of a problem.
But there's a lot of scepticism about these results.
Yes, a vast amount. Possibly no more so than from the researchers who found the results themselves. And what they're doing in publishing them is kind of basically asking the rest of the scientific community to... They're saying, look, we've gone through this. We don't know what's going on. Can you guys have a look and tell us?
Yeah, I mean, there are some scientific theories that state we don't have three dimensions in the universe. We actually have many. Some say 10 or 11, some in excess of 20. And one of the theories could be that if the neutrinos are essentially taking advantage of one of these hidden dimensions that are really small and curled up, one of the things theorized by string theory, for example, it could be that they're essentially taking a shortcut through our sort of three-dimensional space-time, or four-dimensional space-time, if you like. Not to get too deep, they're taking a shortcut, and that's why it looks like they're going faster than they are.
Or it might just be that they've measured the distance between the two labs wrong. It might be as simple as that, or, I don't know, that they're not taking into account the Earth's curvature, or, you know, there could be all sorts of things. And one of the most difficult things is knowing the exact moment that the neutrinos were created in the first place.
Yeah, we're talking...
It's very difficult to measure that.
We're talking such tiny, tiny, tiny fractions of seconds here that, you know, they have to be incredibly accurate.
About 60 billionths of a nanosecond, they reckon it's going faster than the speed of light, with a claimed accuracy of 10 nanoseconds.
Yeah, I love the fact that they did it 15,000 times just to make sure.
Yeah, but 15,000 times and they got the same result every time.
Yeah.
It's not like a mismeasurement.
Maybe the clock's off.
Well, they should get the British to give them an atomic clock, because we've already reported that we make the most accurate ones of those. But we will keep you up to date with what happens here with the neutrino experiments. And obviously, if Einstein turns out to be wrong, we will be the first to let you know, in podcast form at least. But if we are able to travel faster than light, this could make massive problems for Facebook, which last night announced a complete revision to how your profile is going to look. And it will
again.
Yeah.
And it will use something called the Facebook timeline. And what this is, if you imagine when you're using Facebook, you post an update and maybe a week later, several dozen posts later perhaps, that week old update is no longer on your profile. It's old, it's gone, it's forgotten. What if that profile post was about you getting married or was about, you know, this amazing new job that you got? It's kind of a really important post. How do you display those basically for all time? They just get lost. What the Facebook timeline aims to do is to give you a profile that lets you show these amazingly important moments in your life on your profile in a way that can be browsed and kind of remains there for all time.
And you can add things in from before when Facebook launched, can't you? So it was 2004 when it launched, and you can add stuff in going back to your birth date.
You can essentially have a profile that starts from the moment you were born by putting a baby photo there and has every single important moment of your life from birth to present day displayed for all to discover, scrape and exploit.
I suspect that most people's profiles are going to have some fairly important, like the level of importance of posts is going to dramatically decrease as you get older, because you're going to have your birth and all the significant childhood moments that you're going to retroactively put in there. And then you're going to have so-and-so likes this picture of a dog wearing a hat.
Yeah, but you know what? Those are the posts that aren't going to appear on here. You know, you can hide them. You can mark them as important. And the really important ones, you can go back and you can choose a picture to mark that moment. So you're kind of building a profile in a retroactive way and saying these are the really important moments in addition to you know, to where you're employed at the moment and things like
good
that.
Good for babies.
Now we've been testing this out in the office and you know, what do we think? Do you like it?
I like it. And when I first saw it last night, I was initially kind of creeped out because I was at the Facebook F8 conference and they showed this video of the timeline. And if anyone can remember seeing the Truman Show, that old Jim Carrey film where his life is on show from birth onwards, kind of Big Brother style, they had this video where they sort of showed this guy posting a picture as a baby, and then it sort of zoom forward a bit and it had him in his first graduation, then at his wedding, then his wife was pregnant, and then the baby photo was posted, and it really was kind of creepy because it looked just like something from the Truman Show.
Yeah.
I mean, my first thoughts when I saw all this stuff was just like, whoa, that's a lot of stuff that I've put on Facebook over the years. You know, that was my immediate gut reaction. But then quite quickly I got over that and I was like, oh, hang on. So what was the first thing I posted on Facebook? And, you know, what was I doing in this month at this time? And it's actually quite nice to have that archive that you can go back to and sift through and choose how public or private you want it to be.
They're putting a much more of an emphasis on images as well, which makes it look a lot nicer. Although I still think that the actual timeline itself is a little bit confused to try and scan. But it's nice.
But it's a work in progress. And, you know, you do have granular controls over what appears on it.
Well,
and
I think you've got to go back and granularly control them.
But you know what? The other thing that just struck me is this feels like something that's built for babies. It's a way of Facebook saying, do not leave Facebook because you're leaving your life's record behind.
Your baby's behind.
And imagine this. You have a baby. You set up a Facebook account for your baby. Begin privately logging everything you do. You're 18, you get given the password, and boom, there's your entire Facebook history ready to be completely milked by advertisers in 20 years' time.
Oh, it's just delightful. The gift that keeps on giving.
But that's not the only thing that Facebook unveiled last night. What else did they do, Nate?
Well, they also completely rethought how their kind of open graph, which is kind of their platform and their sort of, you know, how apps interact with your timeline and your wall, they completely rethought how that operates. And essentially what they've let developers do, for example, Spotify, is let, say, every song that you listen to appear on your wall, or let every song that you listen to appear in real time with your friends, and let people like certain songs and listen to songs at the same time. You know, if I see Liv is listening to, you know, some dubstep track that I didn't know existed, for example, I could click on that song and it would just begin playing in Spotify, and we'd be listening to it at the same time, and then other people would see that I'm listening to that. And that's kind of amazing, I imagine.
Yeah, well, I think it's really interesting because it reinforces a concept that has kind of been pushed by Spotify and a few other people, but is actually quite unwelcome by the wider music industry, which is that music is free, which is that if somebody else is listening to something, you can just hit play and then you'll be listening to it as well. That kind of flies in the face of a lot of what the music industry has been pushing over the last few years, certainly the recorded music industry.
There's a knock-on effect with both of the two things that we just discussed, which is how this new kind of timeline and profile page ties in with this new granular ability that apps have with interacting with your wall. And one of the advantages is actually something that won't start to happen for several months. And it's basically you will be able to go back through your timeline and have a look at, you know, say the number of times you listened to a certain song in 2010, or you know, you could get a yearly cooking report if you're using cooking apps.
So you'll be able to get nice infographics and visuals all documenting your life in a really cool way, which probably they've been able to do behind scenes for a long time, but now they can, you can actually play around with those yourself.
Of course, within the area of music, this is something that Last.fm has been doing for so long now, and Facebook's announcement very much pisses on their chips, so to speak.
It does a bit. But last night at the conference, I spoke to Eric Walfoss, who is from SoundCloud. He's one of the co-founders, I believe. And Duncan, just briefly, actually, explain how SoundCloud works. I know you use it.
Oh yeah, SoundCloud is basically a kind of it's a space on the internet where you can share and host audio files, and it's kind of used by the music industry to share promotional tracks, or by artists to kind of exchange ideas with each other. It isn't really like a Spotify or anything like that. It's much more focused around individual just tracks.
And they were one of the launch partners for this new platform, and their service is going to be integrated. So I first asked Eric, just really briefly, how the integration of SoundCloud on Facebook will work.
So what's really cool about this new integration is that it makes it so easy to and seamless to share onto Facebook. So basically, if you use, for example, let's say our iPhone or Android apps to record something, when you know, walk around on the street, you find something interesting, you talk about it, you share it, that's going to appear like seamlessly onto Facebook, onto the ticker, so basically a real-time display of what you just shared. And then you also have it appear in like this new timeline view. So that's going to sort of appear there and be like blend in with the rest of the content on your profile.
And really, it's this timeline view that is going to become most beneficial for a lot of these apps and for users. And so I also asked Eric what the platform will be like, at least for SoundCloud, sort of what it can do it from in a year's time.
So I think, I mean, the way we see it is that when this rolls out now, these profiles are going to be awfully, you know, quiet somehow. So the past of these timelines is just mute. And what we you know, find really interesting here is that 1 year from now, I think that a lot of these profiles are going to contain lots of interesting sounds from the past from all of these people, which is, you know, never, it's like unheard of before, so that's really cool.
So the big question for me is how much of this data can you then get out of Facebook again afterwards? They're making it very, very easy to put this stuff in, but are they going to make it exportable?
Well, Facebook does let you export data, but it's not in a sort of universally accepted standard format. You kind of have to dig around it a bit. I think there's going to come a point where they absolutely have to make all this standard and open, otherwise people will just shy away, I think. But that's enough about Facebook. Let's leave the social world behind and talk a little bit about hydrogen fuel cars, or at least cars powered by hydrogen fuel cells.
Yes.
Liv, the UK is about to get something oh so exciting.
Yeah, well, there might not be any hydrogen fuel powered cars, but there is now a hydrogen fuel station that's opened up for business somewhere along the M4 between London and Swansea.
So for people who own a hydrogen fuel cell powered car, of which there are how many in the UK, I wonder?
A handful. I mean, you have to have imported them. There's none kind of available at retail, if that's what it's called for cars.
And as far as we're aware, no plans to bring any more.
No, but Honda is obviously a pioneer in this, and they're the people who brought this station in. And so it's a nice kind of almost a marketing initiative, I guess. But it's a good kind of flag in the ground for Honda.
There are a few hydrogen fuel cell recharging stations in the UK already, but I think there are a couple in Wales at a university. You know, they're all kind of at sort of, you know, established places like universities, as opposed to just being a part of a petrol pump. Whereas in Germany, and say, I think in Berlin, where I've actually been in one of these hydrogen cars, they have them just next to their petrol pumps. They have quite a few.
That's cool.
And they look and operate pretty much exactly the same as a petrol pump. So I don't know. This has been going on for years and years and years, and they still haven't quite taken off yet. But the fact that you can fill a car up with hydrogen and its exhaust is water is always going to be something.
It takes 5 minutes, unlike you know, electric vehicles that can take 12 hours to recharge.
So at least the UK is getting on board. perhaps too late. Who never? Who knows? I don't know. Let's go to space. China is going to take over from the ISS, the International Space Station, a topic we've discussed quite a lot recently.
Yeah, so if the ISS is still going by 2020, it's due to be decommissioned. And there's kind of a growing question over what we're going to do next in space. But China isn't really taking part in that. They're just doing their own thing. And they're sending up an unmanned rocket named Heavenly Palace, or Tiangong-1, into orbit, which is going to be the first part of their new space station.
So when will all this get going? When's China getting up there?
Well, the rocket they're sending up in the next week or so is going to be unmanned. And then if that succeeds, fine. They're going to send up another spacecraft to try and dock with the module. And if that all goes according to plan, then sometime in 2012, the next couple of rockets, Shenzhou 9 and 10, will start ferrying astronauts up there and beginning occupation.
And then just a few years until it takes over from the ISS.
In 2020.
Poor ISS. Well, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, are we on the verge of being able to record our own dreams?
The Wired 2011 Summit is less than a month away. Don't miss your chance to hear inspiring talks by speakers from Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft Research, IDEO, McLaren, Refugees Reunited, London Serpentine Gallery, and dozens more. For tickets and more information, visit wiredevent.co.uk.
So are we about to be able to record our own dreams? The short answer is no. The long answer is no. But some steps have been made, at least in that general sort of direction.
Yeah, this is incredible. Neuroscientists at the University of California, Berkeley, have worked out a way of reading kind of blood activity in your visual cortex using a magnetic resonance imaging scanner, and then associating that with video clips. So working out exactly what features in visual clips trigger what responses in the brain.
So hang on, is it this a case of it's not about just reading the brain and then working out exactly what someone's seeing? Is it about having seen a video before and then being able to match it to that video, the activity?
Well, what they've done is they've they got a load of volunteers together. And in fact, the volunteers were members of the research team because they had to sit stock still inside the scanner for hours and hours at a time. They watched two sets of trailers while the machine measured blood flow in their visual cortex. And what they did is when they watched the first set of trailers, they tried to, using a computer model, associate the brain activity with what was happening on the screen.
Yeah.
But with the second set of clips, they tried to predict what that brain activity would be based on the on-screen patterns. And to give it ammunition for that task, they gave it 18 million seconds worth of random YouTube videos.
And the result is a side-by-side video that is quite creepy to watch.
Yeah, it's a kind of merging of the 100 YouTube clips that were found to be kind of generate a response that was most similar to the clip they watched, merged together, giving a kind of blurry but recognizable representation of what's going on screen. You can see figures, you can see lines on the screen. It's really, really almost sinister. But of course, this is still some way away from being able to think, you know, be able to visualize on a video screen what people are necessarily thinking about and visualizing in their minds, because that doesn't necessarily involve the same parts of the brain.
But yeah, because it was 100 predefined clips and the associated behavior in the brain of when you watch those clips. So to match them, it's all more of a game of pairs than a game of, you know, reinterpreting the brain activity.
Yeah, it's more of a statistical exercise than anything else, rather than any kind of like trying to read minds as such.
But it's awesome.
But that's what they hope, right?
Once you get a Google algorithm in there, and it'll be sorted.
And it could definitely be able to, like today it can be used to try and find out what's going on in the minds of people who, you know, can't communicate verbally, you
or
know, coma patients or something like that, or won't, I suppose. But in terms of kind of probing their brain health, it can be very, very useful in that. But we're still, you know, decades away, according to one of the paper's lead authors. What's his name? Shinji Nishimoto, who says, yeah, we're still decades away from scanning other people's thoughts and intentions. And he also said that there's no known technology that could send signals to the brain that could be used to elicit an image or a thought.
Someone please keep Mark Zuckerberg away from this, because I do not want to see my dreams in my future timeline. You know, 2013, Nate dreamed about a cat dressed up as a vicar parading
around.
And here
we've got someone selling one.
Yeah, I do not want that. You need to really watch the video to sort of fully grasp how bizarre and fascinating this is. If you go to wired.co.uk and search brain scanner movie, you will find the story that we are talking about, and it's highly recommended. So on the topic though of brains and emotions, a site has launched, I think this week, or certainly very, very recently, called Emotional Bag Check. Liv, yep. You described this as OMG, so emo.
Yeah, this is about if you've got a problem and you can't speak to one of your friends or family, you can go online and you can log it anonymously to a website, leave your email, and someone else can get back to you with a solution to your problem, or at least to make you feel better, and a song suggestion to accompany said problem.
You probably can't see the sense of absolute hate and disgust on Liv's face, but it's the sight of a woman who is very unimpressed.
No, I think it's a nice sentiment. I like the exchange, but I just don't think that having a song suggestion sent to you from over the world is going to, you know, make your problems a whole lot better.
I don't know.
Especially seeing as you could match up your music taste to someone over the world, that would make it more interesting. But, you know, I don't want to get an Evanescence tune sent over to me when I'm, you know, upset about my dog dying.
This site was built by a New York coder called Robin Overstreet, and we had a little chat to her, and I asked her about why using the site feels so compulsive, because when you log onto it and you say you want to help somebody with a problem and their problem comes up on screen, you suddenly feel this intense sense of duty to make sure that you pick exactly the right song. And I asked her about that, and she said that she thinks that having to think of a song kind of gives a context, a kind of jumping off point for giving advice and support. You don't actually have to write a message if you don't want to. You can just send a song. But trying to think of that perfect song is a kind of way of reflecting on the person's problems, their situation.
Well, I have a problem. It's that I don't want my dreams being recorded by Facebook in 20 years' time. What song would you suggest to me, Liv?
I would suggest Chesney Hawke's The One and Only. Or Nyan Cat, the dubstep remix.
None of those have anything to do with brains.
Does it matter? It gets into your brain.
Oh, I'm sick of it already. Well, if people want to check out the site, I think it's emotionalbagcheck.com.
That's exactly right.
Or search Emotional Bag Check on wired.co.uk and you'll find our super informative story. And on that highly musical note, we are going to move on to our feature this week, which comes from Katie, who has been exploring the weird and wonderful floors of the 100% Design Conference.
100% Design is one of the hundreds of events taking place across London as part of the city's annual design festival. It sees designers from all over the world bring their creations to the hallowed halls of Earl's Court, where everyone from journalists, fellow designers, buyers and interior design obsessives will cast their discerning eyes upon them. We headed to the show to see gorilla chairs, inflatable buildings and 3D printed alpaca wool covered lights, and to speak to some of the designers about their creations. But first, we caught up with Chris Lefteri, curator of the materials section, who talked us through the highlights of the stand.
Well, the stand this year is themed the A to Z of smart materials, Hello Future, because there's a real trend now for smart technologies, and by that I mean technologies that are responsive, technologies that change when you touch them, change colour, that are pressure sensitive or light up in clever ways. And so it's really about the whole interactivity between a digital information and a physical experience. So we have fabrics that will glow up when you put a battery next to them. We have materials that are pressure sensitive. We've also got materials that when you apply heat, like a hairdryer, will expand, which are really interesting because you can print with them. So you could print inks that when you put your hand on the ink would actually, you know, swell up.
Are any of these actually being used by designers at the moment?
The whole point of the stand of 100% materials isn't really to showcase designs that have already been done, but actually to put things out there for interior designers and architects that say, you know, here are the possibilities for you.
Talking about the materials which are available now, what technology would you say over the last couple of years has had the biggest impact on the design industry? And obviously this can be your own personal point of view as a designer yourself.
I think it's this interactive technology, and that's not restricted to, let's say, fabrics or, you know, plastics or metals. It's just about different technologies that can be embedded into any of those materials that are silently, I would say, reacting to environments and habits and how we live. So it's very difficult to pinpoint a particular technology. I think lighting, for sure, has an enormous impact. I think textiles have an enormous impact. We have some materials from a Swiss company called Sephar, who produce very high-tech textiles, one of which is a self-illuminating fabric. And we have two different types of self-illuminating fabric. They produce one of them, which really is just a textile that becomes a light. And David Chipperfield has used one of their materials at the Size and Matter installation outside the Royal Festival for the London Design Festival. So I think that area of textiles is another big area, because there are huge innovations in textiles, not just in sort of lighting or visual things like David Chipperfield's installation, but also textiles that are responsive to our bodies. You know, textiles that can gather data about our temperature, our well-being, monitor our heart rates. So that's another example of the whole relationship between data and apps you might have in your phone, and materials being manifested as part of that in a physical world. I think this idea that we've had in the past of you make something out of metal and it becomes beautiful and sculptural, or you carve something out of wood. You know, and 100% design is filled with beautiful pieces of design that are based on very traditional materials. But the future is going to be defined by this interactive element. So it's not just a piece of wood, it's a piece of wood that is doing something. You may not see it do something, and you may not be able to feel it in any way, but it has a sensor, or it has something that changes according to its environment. And we have a plaster that interior designers could consider using for kitchens or changing rooms in sports halls, where they absorb smell. We've also got materials that you can put into plaster that regulate temperature. So, just like a white wall, but when the temperature in the room rises, it stores that heat, and it will only release heat when the temperature drops. So you have a self-regulating room. And this is stuff you can just apply really easily. I find that we're in a position now with materials and technologies and design where the things that I saw as a child on the Jetsons or on Star Trek, it's here. And if it isn't here, it's definitely being pioneered.
And one of these future materials is Bare Conductive, a paint that conducts electricity, which a team of Royal College of Art students first showed Wired way back in 2009. They have now perfected and packaged it for the mass market. Here's Isabel Lizardi talking about the paint and its applications.
Hi, I'm Isabel from Bare Conductive, and what we're showing here today is a non-toxic, water-based conductive paint, which can be used to create interactive surfaces and to basically bring interactivity to anyone who wants to play with electronics at home. And we have a few demonstrations using the paint to create switches or to create soft circuitry and just fun interactive toys.
And now onto the Light Fantastic. French outfit Nanolight supplied the lighting for the material's standard 100% design using electroluminescent arrays. We caught up with Robert Folly, who explained how they are being used now and whether these low energy and malleable lights could be used in all of our homes.
We use a new kind of technology using a phosphor crystal on an aluminium foil. These crystal phosphor are excited by high frequency and it makes the phosphor vibrate. So when it vibrates, the phosphor just light up. So the technology can take the form of a slice of paper and no more than 0.2 millimeter, which is very, very thin. We do custom shape, custom white, custom length. It's the longest light bulb in the world, because we can, with one connection light, nearly 1 kilometer of light, which is kind of very impressive and low energy consumption. Here in 100% design, we wanted to show to designer and architect, when they sketch, they use what three forms: the segment, the angle, and the curve. So with all the representation we've done here, we show that with Nanolight you can do whatever you want to create. So it opened new roads for creation with light, and also with a very future, and I will say a Tron, attitude of lights.
And if these lights are much lower energy than traditional lights, then would it be better for the environment if they were used in homes instead of the traditional bulbs that we use?
It's low consumption, but you have to take in consideration the use and application of the technology. It's more for signage You will never, for the moment with this technology, light for read the book or some, this kind of stuff. It will only be to for decorative light, lounge light. We use them, for example, in bar, restaurant, nightclubs, this kind of application, or sternosing for emergency exit, for all this kind of stuff, but not for a really lightning stuff. This will evolve during the year. We improve with the factory the lighting level every year, but for the moment, this organic technology is not sufficient for real lighting as we talk about for shops or this kind of stuff. It's more for design stuff.
But in the future?
Yeah, in the future, we hope that with A3 format post on the post on the road, we will be able to light a circle of 10 meters. So this is the future, but we're talking about 8-10 years.
From bendy lights to blow-up buildings, Inflate has been creating inflatables of all sizes for around 15 years. Its range goes from the office in a bag that can be installed in less than 10 minutes through to the Trident 24, which can seat 360 people. We took a perch on a blow-up chair to catch up with Laurie Jones from Inflate to ask whether we could all be living in inflatable buildings in the future.
100% design this year. We've got a range of our indoor structures. We also do outdoor structures. So the idea is that they're temporary portable solutions for anything from an office, temporary office space to an exhibition environment. We also have a stock range of structures. We also do bespoke designs for clients. I mean, the real advantage is their flexibility. It's a very design-led agency. We do lots of outdoor structures as well for big clients. So, that's the kind of the way we work.
And how are they actually powered? Because obviously they're inflatable buildings. So how does it actually work?
Yeah, absolutely. They're not airtight like a Lilo or a beach ball would be. They're made of ripstop nylon. So there are fans that are needed to power the structures, which are based in the back of the structure, which are integral. So they just Velcro rip in and out. So they're a very simple solution. And we use fans that are low pressure, so they don't take a lot of energy, and they can be pulled down with a dimmer switch to reduce the power level as well, so they're not too noisy in this kind of environment.
Once a structure like this is put outside, how long can it stay out there?
Indefinitely, as long as it's maintained and looked after properly. You can take it up, put it down as many times as you like, or it can be used for a single installation, for pretty much indefinitely. We've got another solution, which is a new business of ours called AirClad, which incorporates timber cladding into inflatable structures as well. So it's whilst it's still classed as a temporary structure, it's a little bit more semi-permanent. So if you are thinking about keeping something up for a year, then that could be an alternative as well.
And last of all, are we all going to be living in inflatable buildings in 10 years' time?
That's the idea. That's what we think. Yeah, no reason why that shouldn't happen. Yeah.
That was our roundup of some of the many weird, wonderful, fantastic and terrifying objects that are on show at 100% Design this year. For those who fancy a visit, it's open this Sunday, the 25th of September, to the general public. And in the meanwhile, check out wired.co.uk for our gallery of some of the products mentioned in this week's podcast and much more.
Oh, I definitely, definitely want to work in an inflatable office.
Yeah, me too.
I mean, just imagine, you want to sleep, you just fall over.
Yeah.
It's the best way to live. Duncan, would you like an inflatable office?
I think that would be fun.
I mean, you're not having one before me. Obviously, I'm going to pull rank on that count. But
I'd rather have a ball pool office. I think that would be much more fun.
Oh, God, that'd be amazing too, actually.
That could be arranged.
Well, if you want a ball pool office, you should tell Liv, and she's going to tell you how to tell her.
Okay, I will then. You can follow us on Twitter. We're on @WiredUK.
And Duncan, if people don't use Twitter because they want to go and use the Facebook timeline, how do they do that?
Well, you can go onto Facebook and go to facebook.com/WiredUK. Or if you're a bit more old school than that, you can email us podcast@wired.co.uk.
We look forward to reading your electronic post. But until next week, stay excellent to each other. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Egg related, it's chicken related.
Chicken related, yeah.
Oh.
Really,
it was a poultry
chicken
effort.
Egg. Poultry.